You're listening to a news report podcast from thebodypro.com, the HIV resource for healthcare professionals.
Hi, this is David Wohl from the University of North Carolina, and I'm here with Bonnie Goldman, editorial director of thebodypro.com. Bonnie and I are going to discuss revisions to the recommendations for HIV testing in healthcare settings in the United States issued by the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control, and their implications for clinical management of HIV and also our ability to contain this epidemic. And we're going to break this up into a few different sections and try to describe the landscape in which HIV testing is being done nowadays. And also try to explain the motivations behind the CDC recommendations issued way back in 2006, but only slowly emerging now into practice, and also any evidence that's out there that these changes are having its intended effect. And lastly, what are some of the obstacles that are preventing the recommendations from being fully implemented in ways that people are working around that? So I think to start off, what we should do is explain why we need to expand HIV testing, and I think we're preaching to the choir for the people who would be most likely to be listening to us right now, understand fully that we're in the midst of a really horrific epidemic and that we haven't been able to contain this the way that we would like to. The prevalence of people living with HIV infection has increased as HIV therapies have become more potent and more effective and have prevented deaths. But at the same time, the incidence of HIV infection continues fairly unabated. And we've learned recently that the CDC was about off by 40% in their estimates of how many people are getting infected with HIV every year. And rather than around 40,000 people per year getting newly infected, we find out it may be around 55,000, 56,000, maybe even as high as 60,000 persons per year. So we're feeding the pool, and more people are living with HIV in our country. And as many of you are aware, there are some subgroups where we see more HIV infection, where the increase has been much more dramatic, namely men who have sex with men. We're seeing subpopulations of men who have sex with men that are increased risk. And these are data that have come out over the last year or so and have helped us target HIV testing. So when we talk about HIV testing, we're not only talking about expanding this and making it more routine, but not forgetting that there are certain groups that we have to pay more attention to as well. One thing that has been fairly consistent in most of the data that's been presented to date is that there's a sizable population of HIV-infected persons who are unaware that they're infected. And most of the data indicate that of the million or so people with HIV in our country, about a quarter or a third don't know that they're infected. Some estimates and some modeling indicates that they account for more than half of the new infections that go on every year. So this is a big deal, and identifying those persons who are unaware that they're HIV infected has become paramount in our thinking about how to contain this epidemic. Again, there are some epidemiological clues, but there are others who don't fall into any of the higher risk categories who can be infected. Many women do not have a concentration of high-risk behaviors or risk factors, yet have been infected because a partner has had some risk factors. So we have to think beyond just these specific categories. Thus, there's been an effort to think about how do we reach those people who don't know they're HIV infected, who unwittingly may be transmitting their virus to others. Recognizing the data and where they were trending, the CDC rightly convened a series of meetings to address whether the old paradigm for HIV testing, which was well thought out over many years, but responded to the initial aspects of the epidemic, was outmoded and needed to be updated and streamlined, because HIV testing is somewhat cumbersome when done in the traditional manner of extensive pretest counseling, doing the test, and then a waiting period, usually if you're not using a rapid test, bringing people back, and then doing post-test counseling. Written informed consent has to be in there. And that was proving to be rather burdensome. There are clinicians in the community for whom those extra steps made it very difficult to order and follow up on HIV testing. And basically ruled out emergency rooms and urgent care centers from doing it because of the need to track down people and bring them back in, et cetera. So recognizing this, there's been a new set of recommendations, and that's what we're going to talk a little bit more about today. So I think the pressing need is that we're seeing this, you know, unabated incidence of HIV infection that has not changed at all in aggregate. There's been subpopulations where we've seen plateauing of the epidemic, but others where we're seeing an increase, namely men who have sex with men. So even those who are getting tested seem to be getting tested pretty late, and that is causing a lot of difficulty as well. 190 is the median CD4 cell count on presentation with HIV in our country. Thus, not only is HIV testing missing people who don't know that they're HIV infected, but of those people who are motivated to go out and get testing, they're getting tested rather late in their disease. Late testers tend to be younger, often they're heterosexual, less educated, and more likely to be African-American or Hispanic, according to data from the CDC, looking at 16 states where they looked at individuals and when they tested.
Were there regional notes about this? Was this mostly in the South?
No, this was a diverse collection of different states. It wasn't concentrated in the South. And again, it fits with what we would think, that heterosexuals may perceive themselves to be at less risk. Those who are less educated may be less informed or have less access because it may be a surrogate for poverty or living in places where there's not as many resources. Younger folks perceive themselves to be at less risk than older individuals. And African Americans and Hispanics, again, access to care, perceptions of risk, acceptance of wanting to get tested, these things can differ based upon a whole bunch of different socio-demographic factors. It's also interesting that when you look for reasons for testing and compare late testers versus early testers, those who tested less than a year before an AIDS diagnosis versus those who tested greater than 5 years before an AIDS diagnosis, when you look at the late testers, more likely they're to be tested in the context of an illness. So they were sick and they got tested. And many people do come in now and get tested when they're sick with an AIDS-defining illness, whereas the people who were early testers tested way before they get an AIDS diagnosis. People were more likely to come in because their partner was perceived at risk, or they perceived themselves to be at risk, or they just wanted to know. Or, importantly, for the discussion we're going to have today, they got tested during a routine checkup. So the routine checkup, the routine medical encounter, was an opportunity for them to be tested, whether they brought that motivation to the encounter or their clinician suggested it to them. So there's really a difference between late and early testers. Late testers very rarely get tested during a routine checkup or because they wanted to know or because they thought they were at risk. They're much more motivated by symptoms, and so it's sort of imposed upon them.
There was some interesting studies about these late testers, and many of them, even though they were participating in high-risk activities, did not know that those were high-risk activities.
This is the paradox, that I call it, of our current epidemic. There's a disconnect in HIV knowledge and understanding among the general population and in subpopulations that are much more at risk for HIV than others, despite many more opportunities to know about HIV via the internet, via TV, and other media and movies. Whereas, you know, 10, 15 years ago, where we didn't have as ready access to some of these technologies, there was quite a bit of understanding about HIV in the communities affected. So we are seeing this knowledge gap. Oftentimes, not everywhere and not always, and there's differences between rural settings and metropolitan settings and different parts of the country and different age groups. This very prevalent illness and infection in our country, with one out of every 300 persons of being HIV infecting the United States, how do we approach that? And I think the CDC's very, very rational approach has been we make this a much more routine aspect of medical care. And as we'll get into, there's some precedent for this. And I think they're also being driven by data that show that even those of us who are in the know, even when we're confronted with people who are basically screaming out to be HIV tested, we're just not doing as good a job as we should. There are data that are pretty striking, looking at a large group of individuals hospitalized in a privately insured program who came into the hospital with conditions that are associated with AIDS. And by that I'm talking about like Burkitt's lymphoma, primary CNS lymphoma, encephalopathy, wasting, histoplasmosis, Mycobacterium avium, all the way down to CMV retinitis and PCP. And remarkably, the HIV screening rate for these individuals was fairly low, under 25%, and usually under 10% of individuals coming into this system were not tested for HIV, even though they had indications for HIV testing. Again, as a healthcare system, we just haven't always risen to the occasion, and there's been unevenness in our ability to diagnose people with HIV. Varicella zoster, tuberculosis, or a positive PPD, a sexually transmitted disease, these are absolute indications for HIV testing, or at the very minimum, taking a very detailed sexual history and drug use history. There was this sentiment early on, well, why would I want to know that I'm HIV infected when they can't do anything about it? Those are the days when we had only AZT, and we've come a long way, of course. And so there's additional motivation for individuals to get HIV tested because, A, we can improve their health by getting their virus under control. B, try to prevent them from getting opportunistic infections by using not only antiretrovirals but prophylaxis when needed. And C, reduce their infectiousness so that they don't infect someone else, and coupling that with risk modification interventions. So there's a whole lot of really good reasons and rationale for expanding testing now that maybe weren't as operative way back when.
Dr. Wall, can we discuss the California study a little bit? I understand that the 59% of the study sample were in the U.S. South, and that they were middle-income people who were middle-aged, and that they were diagnosed properly with AIDS-defining illnesses but never given a HIV test. How are we going to change that? If the same thing is going on among the poor and among the middle class, I mean, it seems like we have a really big problem on our hands.
Well, I think what happens is, and it's hinted at in both the study that was reported from California and in other data, and this is what we're hoping to neutralize with the CDC recommendations for HIV testing, you see very, very young people oftentimes not getting tested, and that may be because there's a perception that they're at less risk or they're not wanting to get tested. Also, for older individuals, oftentimes, and this is pretty consistent through most of the studies I've seen, when you get over 50, when you get over 60, people are not as likely to ask you to get an HIV test because there's embarrassment, because we think that older people, for some funky reason, don't have sex. Physicians just haven't done a really good job of approaching people in an even-handed way. There are these biases that we bring to this encounter where we talk about HIV testing, and we really have to get over that. There are data that show that if you have an objective approach to HIV testing, we do much better, and we actually find more people who are, A, willing to get it tested, and B, at risk, and some of those are infected. And I don't necessarily know that this is a regional issue. I think that this happens all over, and this perception that you're not at risk, I'm not going to offer you the test, and I'm not going to offend you by asking you about it, this is what we have to really, really get over. And that's really a centerpiece of the new recommendations, that HIV testing isn't targeted to specific groups necessarily, and that could be a criticism of this, but that HIV testing becomes still voluntary but routine, and for all persons aged 13 to 64 in healthcare settings, and not based on risk, and that people who are at risk be screened much more often, even annually, and that again is part of the conversation with the individual, including people who are engaging in the behaviors that could lead to transmission of HIV, and testing them on a routine basis without that filtering of risk assessment, which clinicians oftentimes don't do very well, is really important for getting around some of the biases that are brought up by that study and others.
Uh-huh. What's ironic is that many people think that when they get a full checkup, they're being tested for HIV. They don't know there are protections in place. They're so surprised years later when they find out they have AIDS. They got many checkups along the way, and they thought they were being tested for HIV.
Yeah, exactly right. In fact, there was a fascinating study that was presented at the retrovirus conference a couple of years ago and it subsequently has been published from South Carolina. Many people in South Carolina who are HIV infected depend upon Medicaid for their care. So they were able to look back at public health insurance records and look at the time that they were diagnosed and then backward how many encounters with the healthcare system people had. And it was remarkable, both ERs and urgent care centers, but also routine clinician appointments, average of something like 4 in the previous year or so. And the title of their presentation was something like Missed Opportunities. And the missed opportunities were for HIV diagnoses. These are individuals who came in with the typical CD4 count of around 200. So they've been infected for a while, certainly at least a year, but yet had encountered clinicians, encountered medical facilities, did not get HIV tested. And those were missed opportunities to diagnose them at higher CD4 counts and before they came in with oftentimes AIDS-defining illnesses. So this is a really, really important point that I think we have to stress. When the old system was in place, we missed a lot of people with HIV infection. The consequence was we have a sizable proportion of the HIV-infected population who don't know that they're infected. And the other consequence is that people come in late. We also see the same misperception that you're describing in people who are hospitalized. Well, they must have checked me for that. Or incarcerated. People aren't always tested for HIV when they're incarcerated. States have different systems. Jails certainly don't do a whole lot of HIV testing when you look at jails across the country. Some do, some don't. So there's these misconceptions about people getting tested. There's a lot less testing than I think people think there is. Yeah. The other part that I want to highlight about the revised recommendations go beyond just who we should be testing, that sexually active group, age 13 to 64, that doesn't mean, I think, in my mind, that we should stop at 64 and we shouldn't be screening 65-year-olds or 68-year-olds. It depends upon the situation and what's going on. I think that there's no upper limit. I think starting at 13 makes a lot of sense for obvious and disturbing reasons. But the other part of this is that the voluntary nature is still operative, but the informed consent process has been streamlined and made much more efficient. And this, I think, took a little bit of guts on the behalf of the committee to pursue this. What we're talking about is switching from this opt-in scenario where people are asked, do you want to get an HIV test, and they have to say yes, to a situation where basically you can order an HIV test without jumping through those hoops and really give the person an opportunity to say no, much like we do most of our testing. If I wanted to test someone for hepatitis B or hepatitis C or syphilis, I would tell that person I'm going to do that. If they said, well, you know what, I really would rather you not do it, then I wouldn't do it. So that's called opt-out screening, opt-out HIV screening with the opportunity to ask questions and the option to decline is another major aspect of this change that was recommended a couple of years ago. As we'll talk about, there are some legal obstacles in some places, but that's changing over time too. But it's also a sea change in our thinking about HIV as a special entity. Certainly there are things about HIV that are special, but on the other hand, the more we treat HIV like other important diseases, the more we can perhaps move away from the discrimination and the stigma that attends this particular viral infection. Importantly as well, the guidelines indicate that written informed consent need not be obtained. Again, following the case of syphilis, hepatitis C, or prostate-specific antigen, or even some genetic testing, sensitive tests, we don't typically require informed consent to be written. This is a verbal agreement. HIV as well could be handled under that sort of paradigm. And I think that is, again, helpful because it treats HIV like other infections and diseases and also removes this hurdle that people would have to jump over of getting the form, printing it out, having the person sign it and read it, of course. And that just took time, and I think that really made it very difficult for people to do this as much as they should.
Particularly in emergency rooms and places like that.
Particularly, and I think it just, just the man hours and the time and just the interruption of flow made it very difficult. It's that exceptionalism of HIV that's reinforced with that approach. Absolutely. So key, I think, is that the recommendations are, for the moment, based largely in healthcare settings. We're talking about emergency rooms, urgent care clinics, inpatient facilities, certainly STD clinics, TB clinics, public health clinics, substance abuse, correctional facilities, primary care settings. We're deputizing, you know, clinicians at all these different centers and saying to them, this is your opportunity. This is where you may reach a lot of that 25% or so who don't know that they're HIV infected, and offer them HIV testing. There's some special considerations I think we have to also have beyond what we're talking about with expanding HIV testing, making it more routine, and testing individuals across a very, very broad age range. Pregnant women often get prenatal care, and that's another opportunity. And we've done a really good job of offering HIV testing to individuals who are pregnant. And that's had a profound effect, as we know, on perinatal transmission of HIV, because there are certain interventions we can do that are very effective at reducing the risk of transmission. I think we could take a page from that book. And in pregnant women, we are often now providing them with the sort of opt-out scenario for HIV testing, certainly talking to them a lot more about it. The revised recommendations talk to this as well, with opt-out rapid testing with an option to decline for all women with undocumented HIV status who are presenting for prenatal care. Certainly, we know that these women are sexually active because they're pregnant, and trying to do this, especially early on in their pregnancy care, but also screening for HIV again, hopefully in the third trimester when transmission is much more likely during delivery. And then having people sometimes think about rapid testing of the newborn if the mother's status is unknown at delivery, because women may present without prenatal care or have not been offered HIV testing. Newborn testing with a rapid test can be done and is fairly feasible.
I know in New York State, all newborns are tested for HIV.
Right, and there have been a lot of discussions about this. There's a list of different entities that infants are tested for mandatorily, some of which are a lot less common than HIV, especially in certain areas of our country. And so it just makes sense that if this is a bigger health risk than some of the things that we test for, we should do it.
What's interesting about the testing of newborns is there's no opt-out or anything, and most people don't know their infant is being tested.
Yes, and I think this is really interesting, and it engenders a lot of different debating points that we could talk about of autonomy. We see pregnant women tested either themselves or via their newborns, because if you test a baby for HIV antibodies, you're really testing the mom for HIV antibodies. And this has been an age-old debate in New York. Different places are approaching it differently, even in places with opt-out testing. There is certainly a tendency to see really rigorous efforts to test women for HIV who are pregnant. And certainly there are data that indicate that women, when counseled about the benefits of HIV testing and interventions to reduce transmission and improve her health, who are offered voluntary testing, there is extremely high rates of testing acceptance under those circumstances. So this is a group that generally you do not mandatorily have to test. And with the proper resources and the proper instruction, almost universally, women who are of HIV unknown status say yes. And that's according to data that is fairly old by now, and I don't think is out of date at all. Moving on, I think that we have to look at what evidence there is that this new way of thinking about HIV testing actually works. There are a number of different experiences that have been reported where opt-out testing under this scenario has been studied. We know that there have been randomized control trials of opt-out screening for pregnant women. When you look at the trials that have been done, you get about a 35% acceptance of testing using an opt-in consent, the traditional way we've been doing HIV testing in this situation. Women reported feeling that accepting an HIV test is an endorsement of high-risk behavior, whereas in the arms where women were given HIV testing under an opt-out scenario, testing was about 88%, and there was significantly less anxiety about testing. It was perceived as being much more routine as part of the prenatal care. So evidence in that situation that opt-out testing was not looked at as something that was imposing. Opt-out and opt-in testing has been compared in a number of other settings, including STD clinics, and this has been done both in the United States and elsewhere. I think one of the nicest studies we've seen came from the Netherlands, where in Amsterdam, in an STD center that was extremely busy with 25,000 new visits annually, they instituted an opt-out testing program in 2007 and looked back before 2007 at the acceptance rate among clients of the clinic for HIV testing, both in men who have sex with men and heterosexual patients. Remember, these are all people coming into an STD center, so they all have pretty high risk for having HIV, and then looked after January 2007 when the new policy developed. And remarkable changes in the rate of HIV testing in this clinic. When you look at the population that accepted HIV testing, both men who have sex with men and heterosexuals, we saw this dramatic uptake of HIV testing with the opt-out scenario. And what's interesting is that the proportion of people with HIV did not change. So by testing more people, even with the same prevalence, you're identifying more people who have HIV. In 2007, with the full opt-out system in place, only 12% of men who have sex with men and 4% of heterosexuals opted out of HIV testing. That's a fraction of what was seen beforehand, where maybe 40% or more of the men who have sex with men and over 25% of the heterosexuals did not test for HIV in this high-risk setting. There are other data that come from the United States, mostly from Texas, that also looked at opt-out and opt-in testing in STD clinics and found dramatic increases in the number of people saying that they'll get tested with the opt-out scenario. Here in North Carolina, we've looked at this as well in our correctional system, and these are unpublished data, but have been verified that looked at HIV testing under a voluntary opt-in situation before November 1st, 2008, and then subsequently after that date when an opt-out testing policy came into place, HIV testing among inmates coming into the prison increased from around 58% to over 90%. Again, opt-out just seems to streamline things and gets people tested much more efficiently than the old paradigm of opt-in.
Dr. Will, could you describe what you mean by opt-out? What is the actual thing that goes on in a prison or in a clinic? You know, someone is just tested and then told about it? How does that work?
I think we have to stress this over and over again. Opt-out testing is not mandatory testing. When done properly, opt-out testing is the clinician indicating and reporting to the individual patient that they are going to draw an HIV test unless the patient objects, unless the patient says no. What some people are doing, and the recommendations speak to this, is when you come in for general care to a facility, most of us, if not all of us, have to sign some consent to care, the form that says you consent to have this and this done and be treated by this clinician. On that list could be or should be, and we may do HIV testing. Mm-hmm. Now, you don't have to sign that form, or you can sign the form and say, but not that. Again, that doesn't negate that clinician's responsibility that 3 months later or 3 years later after you sign that form, she draws an HIV test, she has to tell you she intends to do that. Again, opt-out testing, incumbent upon that, is an option to defer that testing. It's not mandatory testing. And that's the way it should be practiced. If someone is drawing an HIV test and not telling the individual, that's mandatory testing, and that's not what we're talking about.
But how is that mandatory testing? If a patient comes into a clinic and there's a suspicion of something, and it may not be HIV, the clinician doesn't usually get permission from the patient to get a test for a hep C or for something else.
I think there are some things going that are a little bit different. Again, we don't want to put HIV in a very, very special category, but we can't ignore that it does have some special aspects of it. I would argue that if I was going to test someone for hepatitis C, or hepatitis B, or syphilis, I would probably mention that to that individual. We generally tell people when we're going to check PSA or cholesterol. Now, of course, we don't necessarily tell people when we're going to check a sodium or potassium. I think we have to explain things when they have important ramifications. If I'm going to test you for cancer, that's a big deal. You'd want to know that I was testing you for that. I think the same sort of thing with this. Genetic testing is another one where you would want to just talk to someone before you would just do it. But I think HIV, it's not that different that it has to be in its own category. I think it's very similar to some of these other diseases that a result that comes back, whether positive or negative, has important implications for that person's life. You would want to prepare someone for it. In this case, especially as we're switching from one system where we had to go out of our way to get this person's permission to a new way where we're making it so that the onus is on the patient to refuse the test, I think we should do a good job of advising that person, this is why I want to do it. It's routine. We do it for everyone coming into care, or I'm a little worried about this, or whatever the reason is, that we inform this person. Another nice thing about doing that is then they know. HIV testing is becoming very routine. If you do it blindly, not only do I think you've crossed an ethical line, but I also think you're doing a disservice for the whole rationale for this HIV testing system, which is to make it familiar rather than something that's exceptional.
It sounds like we need a sea change in society before it becomes so not stigmatized. In New York, we had a governor who was caught with sex workers. So some of the people in an emergency room at St. Vincent's were telling clinicians, you got to test people. Just think of Hulda Spitzer, meaning the governor's wife, that she didn't know she was at risk.
There's two sides of the stigma.
Right.
One of the sides of the stigma is the traditional way we think about it, which I don't want to get tested because if I find out that I'm positive, I won't be able to get a job, I won't be able to get housing, no one will sleep with me, all that sort of stuff. But the other sort of stigma you're talking about is really a bias. People think they know what HIV-infected people look like. You're right. This is a big problem. And what I love about these recommendations, it's just so sad that they were issued at the end of 2006, and here we are, beginning of 2009, and this is only slowly leaking out into society and becoming implemented. But what I love about these recommendations is they completely address what you're talking about and hit it head on, which is saying, you know, you should be testing everyone. Now, there are structural impediments for emergency rooms to do what we would like, what would be ideal. And those are fairly obvious, and we could talk about those. But, you know, Silva goes into the local primary care office, you know, where she has established care, you know, this is something that should be on a checklist with her mammogram, with her other types of screening, with her cholesterol screening. This is something that should be part and parcel of the maintenance of well-being that is in our medical care system. The lead that I have for this, I keep coming back to it, is prenatal screening, because we really have done a pretty darn good job of offering HIV testing to a sizable proportion of pregnant women. Now, someone may come in and say, I'm not at risk for HIV, and I don't want you to test me for HIV, even though I'm pregnant. Okay, that's fine, but at least we should be offering it. And what we found is that offering HIV testing as widely as we have, and then doing something about it when people are positive, we have reduced new pediatric HIV to almost an endangered species in most parts of the country. So I really take a lesson from what we've done with pediatric HIV. Now, how did we do that, and what can we do? So this interview, this report, is part of the effort, because the idea is to do what we did for obstetricians, gynecologists, and primary care family practice docs to think about HIV as part of the prenatal screening. We have to do that for the care of the individual coming into primary care. So I think we have to target the clinicians. This is not something you put on the side of a bus. Ask your doctor about HIV testing. No. This is something that should go into medical journals. Ask your patient to get HIV tested. This is what we should be doing. I think this has to be clinician-led.
And it probably should be trained in medical school, because it seems that one of the problems is that people feel awkward asking patients to get tested. It's just too embarrassing for them.
Three words: get over it. We should feel comfortable talking about blowjobs. We should be comfortable talking about rimming. We should be talking about things that our patients sometimes want to talk to us about. They want to talk to us. We think they don't, but they want to talk to us about sex. They want to talk to us about death. There are things we think are taboo. But you know what? When you start to ask people these questions, you get answers. When you ask about sexual orientation, you're afraid to do it. And you find out this guy, he's at risk. You start to get more and more information. These blinders, these perceptions that we have, they keep us from helping people. If you can identify one person at risk for HIV and test them, find out they're HIV positive, get them on treatment, save that life, and prevented them from transmitting it to someone else, it's worth the thousands of times you had to blush a little bit when you had to ask some older woman, are you at risk for HIV? How many sexual partners have you had? And there are instances where elderly women turn out to be HIV infected, and you ask them, and, well, my husband died 10 years ago from a mysterious illness. Or they were sexually assaulted and they don't want to tell anybody. So I really think we should get over it. This is a routine part of medical care. One out of every 300 persons in the United States is HIV infected, and they all don't have the same skin color. They all don't have the same sexual orientation. They all don't have track marks. We don't have x-ray vision. We have to make this much more routine, and we may find out it's a little bit more than one out of every 300 people. That's an estimate. But we won't know until we look at this, and we have a big problem in this country, and I think clinicians here can take a fantastic lead. There's a wonderful study that was done looking at exactly this issue of, well, what if we ask providers to screen people for HIV in an emergency room? Emergency rooms, where it's really, really difficult. This was done in Boston. Versus having a dedicated counselor, an HIV counselor, who staffs the emergency room and asks most everyone who comes in. And as you'd imagine, the providers sucked at this. They didn't do a very good job at all. They looked at over 8,000 eligible people who came in. 59% agreed to participate in this study and were randomized to either getting the provider offering them the HIV testing or the dedicated counselor. 80% of those who were randomized to the counselor were offered an HIV test, compared to a paltry 35% in the provider arm. Acceptance of HIV testing was comparable in the provider, 75%, and counselor arm, 71%. So again, what we're seeing is acceptance of testing was pretty high among people who agreed to it, but so many more people in the counselor arm agreed to be tested. I think that this is really important. It shows that if we have non-denominational, objective people offering HIV testing without those preconceived notions, acceptance rates are fairly high.
It's pretty ironic, because all clinicians use universal precautions. In effect, they're suspecting that everyone may have HIV, but then they feel awkward actually offering a test.
I think some do a really good job, and some don't do a really good job, and there's still a lot of people who are offered HIV testing and don't do it. Data that show that people need some education too. The community needs education. That people still are not getting HIV tested because they're afraid, or because they feel that they don't have much of a risk, that they're not worried about it. We have to get around too. Even in that study from the Netherlands, when you look at the proportion of people, the small proportion who did not get tested, even though these are men who have sex with men, going into an STD clinic in Amsterdam, which must be one of the STD epicenters of the world, and they're saying, "Well, I don't think I'm at risk." That's just madness. So it's not all the clinician. Clinicians can do better. Clinicians have done well before, and many clinicians are leading the way on this. We just have to make this easier and easier. And in emergency rooms, it is difficult. And part of the reason is even rapid testing still takes somebody to do the test or send it to a lab and then get it back, and there's a time element. Different ERs have to work out different ways of doing this. There are data trickling in from different ERs and different hospitals showing that this is feasible, but that systems have to be introduced to do this and to follow up on positive results in real time and, importantly, link people to care. It's not good enough just to say, well, you're HIV positive. There has to be a route by which identified people can get into care in a really, really quick way. Because lots of people can get HIV tested, but that doesn't mean they're going to get into the care they need. It's not automatic. So I think there's a lot of work that's going to continue to be done, especially in urgent care centers, especially in emergency rooms. But we shouldn't focus just on those centers, important as they are. We've got to be doing this at STD centers, which I think are really on board, but also primary care settings, because that's where a lot of people do receive care. So I think it's part of a bigger package, and we have to get over some of these obstacles. Things like the Boston study, where there's a dedicated counselor, where there's a rapid testing with dedicated personnel, these things cost money. This is a question of resources, especially in these times, are very difficult. But I think those are the things we need to move forward. And money doesn't solve everything, but money well spent could get you there a lot quicker. The other thing is that there are states where HIV testing under an opt-out scenario without written informed consent is not permitted. And again, this is changing, and there were a nice report from John G. Bartlett from Hopkins and JAMA in August of 2008 that went state by state and showed where there are legislative restrictions to the CDC recommendations, where there's an evolving change in the legislation, and where the CDC recommendations have already been implemented. Here in North Carolina, we did have a change that allowed us last year to provide opt-out testing in our state, and still, it's pretty spotty. Some hospitals do it, like ours. Other hospitals haven't been able to adopt it yet. So I think we want to put some pressure. I think this is important for our professional organizations. So when we talk about clinicians, we're not only talking about individuals, but we're talking about the august bodies that represent them. This should be something of a priority for the AMA, for other groups that represent clinicians, whether they be family practice docs, internists, OBGYNs, whatever. I think this is really important for us.
One thing that you didn't talk about was the new testing technologies.
And, technology helps us in many, many ways. So, the rapid tests are wonderful for that. And so we've seen really an uptake of expansion of HIV testing. Try to start up a rapid HIV testing program, an outreach program in your community, and you'll find someone else is already there doing it, whether it be a small kind of operation offering it at health fairs or a much more comprehensive program like we have in many parts of rural North Carolina where people are going into bars and people are rolling up their sleeves and giving blood. There's all sorts of initiatives going on in correctional facilities, in emergency rooms, in the urgent care centers we talked about, community health care centers, and that was really helped a lot by the rapid tests. Now, rapid tests aren't perfect, and one of the big problems of rapid tests, of course, are they miss people with acute HIV infection. There aren't going to be a lot of people who are in the acute phase of HIV infection, but it can be sizable, and we have data that show that around 5% of all people getting voluntarily tested who are HIV positive are in the acute phase of the infection and don't have antibodies that would lead them to be diagnosed necessarily by an acute test. There are new technologies that are trying to combine assays or techniques for detecting evidence of the virus itself, either using P24 or other techniques such as the pooling techniques where blood from different people is pooled and tested for nucleic acids that are present in the virus that can help detect acute infection in the absence of antibodies. So I think this is really, really important. And these combined tests that are looking for the P24 antigen of the virus as well as HIV antibodies holds great promise in that that can help us cut down on the number of people who are told you're HIV negative but are in the throes of acute HIV infection.
Could you define acute infection and talk about the tests, like what the window period usually is?
It's acute HIV infection. By that, I mean people who recently caught HIV infection. I'm talking about within the last days or weeks. We know that it could take 3 weeks or a little bit longer before antibodies to HIV are detectable to our standard EIA or ELISA test. So the definition of HIV positive relies upon these antibody tests, but we always know that there's this window period. It used to be as long as 6 months. The newer generation assays that we've had out for the last few years has closed that window down to about 3 to 6 weeks. If by 3 to 6 weeks, most people have started to evolve antibody responses to HIV that allow these HIV antibody tests to be positive, not only by ELISA, but then confirmed by Western blot. But it's this short period of time soon after HIV infection when there's a lot of virus, in the millions sometimes, and no antibodies, that we really get worried about, because our standard HIV algorithms don't detect them. Now, in certain places, including North Carolina, we have a pooling system. People who are HIV tested voluntarily at public venues, their blood is pooled in aliquots that may have as many as 100 people represented in this one tube, and a viral load test can be done on that tube. And if it's negative, no one who contributed to that pool, whose blood was put into that tube, has evidence of HIV nucleic acid. And thus they're antibody negative and they're, you know, RNA negative. But if it's positive, then you can go up generations of these aliquots, because they're broken into, you know, aliquots of 10. Then from the 10, some are put into a master tube. You can go back and find out who has nucleic acid sequences that indicate that they have HIV present in their blood, but no antibodies, and detect acute HIV. So there's different ways of doing this. And the idea is to not miss these folks, because there's pretty decent evidence that people who don't know that they're HIV infected unwittingly are responsible for maybe half of new infections. There's also data that show that people in acute HIV infection are also a leading edge of the epidemic, because you're so much more infectious during that acute period and likely continuing to do the same activities you did that allowed you to get infected in the first place, like a week ago. So here you are with 8 million virus in your blood and probably a similar amount of virus in your semen, and you're going out again on Saturday night doing what you did last Saturday night when you got infected, thus be very likely to infect someone else, and you may not be sick. You may have some symptoms, but you may not have very many symptoms. So technologies that can help us reduce that window and identify people with acute HIV infection has really very important public health significance.
Are there any other states that do this kind of testing?
There's no state that I know that does it throughout the state. There are cities that do pooling, and there are sometimes facilities that do pooling, but pooling has not been widespread. It's not necessarily a very expensive venture, and it does add on a few dollars more to every HIV test, on the order of maybe $3 to $4, but it showed that opt-out testing, pooling, and things like that is cost-effective. And in North Carolina, it's all done with robots, and the state runs this program. And many different states are interested in it. Certainly some cities have taken it on, and San Francisco is an example. But I think that, you know, that's not the answer necessarily for everyone, although I think it's a really good answer. And the people who developed that deserve a lot of kudos. But I think that there are other techniques that are people are trying to use, so they could do point-of-care testing, where you can get an answer much more rapidly and you don't have to wait the days that it takes to do this. And I think that's where the technology is going to drive us, is towards being able to do this in the field, where you can get an immediate answer. We're all about now. We don't want to lose the opportunity of that encounter to have someone leave us and then have to try to find them because they have acute HIV or chronic HIV.
So what can somebody do if they suspect that a patient has acute infection?
I would draw a regular old HIV test, but at the same time, I would draw an HIV RNA level. I think that's the best thing to do. Nothing beats RNA right now. Even P24 has a little bit of a lag compared to RNA. So I would get a viral load test at the same time. I think, again, you really want to be, you know, thinking about this in people who come in, especially to emergency rooms with a viral-like illness and any of the sentinel signs of acute HIV, but it could also look just for all the world like a viral illness. But then that's where history comes in. And it's one of those things where we have to train people, and we're working on this, believe me, where people come in with regular old viral syndromes, and we say, just curious, because there's some stuff that this could also be. Any new sexual partners within the last month or so? Have you ever injected drugs? If you have you shared needles within the last month or so? It doesn't take too long. Get over the embarrassment thing. Get over the perception thing. I don't care what they're wearing or what they look like. Just ask it routinely, and surprisingly, you may find once in a bit an answer you didn't expect.
So would an RNA test in an HIV-negative person be covered by insurance or by public insurance?
It depends. This is an issue that comes up all the time, whether or not any of these things would be covered. Even the opt-out HIV testing has insurance implications for people. Generally, I think what we have to do is drive that argument and not react to it as much. And sometimes we have to tell people, that this is going to be a cost. I think we have to tell people about it. We have to say that this is indicated. We're not ordering HIV RNAs on every single person who comes into an emergency room. What we're talking about is selective use in situations where you think there's acute HIV infection, and you may have to tell someone that this may not be covered because it's not an indicated use of this test. So I think you have to be honest with people about it and just do it. But, that's something that I think is a very individual decision.
Great. Okay. Fabulous discussion.
Good. And I think this is really an important area. It's a moving area, and I do think people have to advocate. I really feel strongly about this. Clinicians have to advocate for these changes and be on the forefront of making this occur. It's going to make or break at the level of the clinician. This is not a community-directed initiative. This is trying to get clinicians to change what they do, and I would like to see more and more evidence-based interventions directed towards clinicians and how to get them to remember to offer HIV testing. There have been some things that have been looked at. They're useful for a while, and then over time they extinguish. There's a lot of things clinicians have to talk to their patients about, whether it be stop smoking, wearing a seatbelt, wearing a condom. I know there's a lot. This just has to be something on the list that we check off every once in a while.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
The opinions expressed by hosts or interviewees in this podcast do not constitute professional advice, should not be considered substitutes for professional services, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of Body Health Resources Corporation or its sponsors. Please see the full disclaimer online at thebodypro.com. If you have comments or questions, please contact us. This has been a news report from thebodypro.com. The opinions expressed by hosts or interviewees in this podcast do not constitute professional advice, should not be considered substitutes for professional services, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of Body Health Resources Corporation or its sponsors. Please see the full disclaimer online at thebodypro.com. If you have comments or questions, please contact us at news@thebodypro.com.